But every place, no soundness at all, no areas of prosperity at all. And we would have to go back to that. And we would not finish the work of God. We would let the work of God simply fizzle. And we will not have a fizzling work. We will finish the work. Now, I know there will be unemployment. I think everything indicates it will have to be over 30% to beat the Great Depression of the 20s and 30s. So that is up to 35 or 40, which means, you know, an awful lot of people out of jobs. And God hasn't called the great of the world. And some of you don't have, you know, fabulous backgrounds in the work area. And some of you do, and some of you don't have a lot of training. And yet God somehow is going to deal with that and work with that. And I'll tell you how in a minute. But it will not be straight across the board. Some areas of the economy will be somewhat healthy. Others will be very, very sick, and we'll have the boom-bust situation. Remember Newfoundland, with 30% unemployed over there, chronically unemployed, virtually all of our members have jobs. And our members are not people of vast education. We have some very simple people. They all have jobs. In areas in Newfoundland where the fishermen sit around and catch no fish, our members who are fishermen always seem to catch some fish, and God keeps them going. In the Cameroons in West Africa, they got 60% unemployment in the Cameroons. Virtually all of our members, dozens of them, have jobs. About 90% have jobs when 60% of their compatriots in their country do not. And we keep the Sabbath and do a lot of things that can create some problems. But you know, the 10% that don't have jobs, you know, generally within 5 or 6 months, God will find them one. They'll find one if they look. But the other 90% that do are always blessed. Just enough so the 10% that don't are able to live, you see. They don't have a social system there with welfare and all these things, all the freebies going out at all. But the brethren with jobs are always blessed so that those who do not have them are helped. And I'll get to the principle of equality. God doesn't mean everybody gets the same amount of money. The principle of equality in the book of Corinthians means that God blesses some and others are given less, and it all works out and there's enough for everybody. That's the manna principle. I'll get to that in a minute. But in the Depression of the 30s, a lot of Americans were destitute and some were not. You see, some did live off the good of the land. And we shall, God says, in the years to come. Now how? I want to show you before I discuss that, though, some of the long-range results in world affairs of breakneck, widespread economic chaos. Remember Germany in the 20s, Adolf Hitler made his first bid for power because of the economic problems in the country. And you've heard of the famous Munich beer hall putsch. I've been in the beer hall that he putsched his putsch in, whatever. I guess a putsch is a kind of a... I don't know what a putsch is, but I don't know. Anyway... he made his first coup, I guess, bid for power there. And that was at the time, a time when the German mark was collapsing and the nation was in financial chaos. And that's why Hitler came to the fore in the early 20s. Now, he didn't come to power for 10 years, but he began to agitate. And it was at a time when the German mark, you see, was literally collapsing as a result of the debacle, the fiasco of World War I. And after World War I was over and pressures we created within that country to some degree, and they blame us for it, by the way, and I'll get to that later if I have time, they went into a time of horrendous inflation, and Hitler came to the fore and said, I'll resolve the problem. The German people must not live with this kind of economic chaos. And it was chaos. I mean, those were the grim, dark days when Germans were dealing with inflation unheard of in human history in a civilized country. At the close of 1921, I'll give you some statistics, prices were 35 times higher than in 1913. You think that's bad? That was just the beginning. At the end of 1922, prices were 1,475 times higher than in 1913. You think that is bad? By the end of 1923, hold on to your hats, prices in Germany were 1,422,900,000,000,000 times higher than in 1913. Can your mind even begin to think in those terms? I mean, the nation was shattered. And the dollar was worth, in 23, just a tad under a trillion marks, and which is awful. And people, you know, those were the times that you've heard of when literally in stores and shops, people didn't count your money. You took it in a basket, and they weighed your money, you see. They weighed it. They didn't even bother to, you know, go through it one by one. Those were the days when women would go to their husbands' jobs and factories and plants with big, huge, you know, laundry baskets. And men got paid at the end of every day because every day prices went up by 3, 4, 5,000%. And they would simply fill baskets with, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of marks. And people would run to the stores because the prices went up every hour. The prices would triple or quadruple on the hour. And every hour made a huge difference in what you paid. Now, the German nation was scarred by that, brethren, and the scars have not healed. You need to understand that. That's why the Germans have always been very parsimonious, very abstemious, very, like this in a sense, in economic things. And it was under Hitler, made his bid for power. It took him 10 years. And the reason, ultimately, that he began to persecute the Jews. There are many, many reasons for it. And, it was a horrendous thing that he did. But one of the major reasons that he claimed was that he said the Jewish people in Germany directed the economy. He said they were the bankers and the entrepreneurs. And he blamed the Jews for the economic woes because he said they held the economic purse strings. And Hitler said we must eliminate the Jews so we can cut the purse strings off from the Jews and that we must punish them for having wrecked the nation. Well, that was one of his excuses that he used to unleash this horrendous bloodbath that went on for 15 years, really, if you go back to the beginning when he began the initial persecution. To save the economy, he said the Jews must be eliminated. Brethren, who's being blamed for the economic woes of the world right now? Not the Jews. Americans are. You realize that? When the Germans get together and discuss how to somehow do something with the economy of their nation, they yell and scream and carry on about the dollar and our economic policies, and we're getting the blame this time around. That's a little chilling. Now, who panicked the most in 72, I should say, when the devalued dollar in the early 70s upset the equilibrium of the European money market? You know who panicked the most? The French? Oh, the French don't even bother with things like that. They're too busy drinking wine, enjoying life, walking around in parks and looking at the sky and writing poetry. The French do enjoy life, and the world can collapse all around them, and they take scant notice of it. It's just their natures. It's a beautiful trait of character. I wish I was like that. You know what the Germans did? They had a fit in 72 when the dollar began to upset this equilibrium because they remember 1922, and they have not forgotten. Now, do you remember in March of 78 when the Germans offered to lend the Americans, we Americans, wasn't it 2 billion Deutschmarks that they were going to lend us so that we would have the cash to buy back $1 million, euro dollars, the money that we sent to Europe floating around in Europe, which upsets the economy over there and creates instability, and the Germans keep saying, get your dollars out of Europe. We keep saying, well, we can't afford it. And they say, well, we'll loan you 2 billion Deutschmarks so you can buy your own crummy dollars back and get them out of our country. I don't think we accepted the offer, but I think you begin to see the panic in the minds of the Germans who have gone through the worst economic crises of any modern nation that I know of. Except with some of the nations in South America. Well, the Europeans don't want to see 1922 reoccur. That was a time when it took 20 million Deutschmarks to buy a spool of thread. And someday, you see, their greed for power, their need for economic stability, which is very, very strong because of their scars and the memories. And this is in their history books. When they read history, they learn about that. You don't. Most Americans have never heard of that occurring. They're going to unleash someday a very convulsive, violent time. It'll be based upon hatred for the USA. But rather than that, hatred will have many, 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 many states, many props, many sources. And the economic crisis in the world, and they do blame us for it, whether we're totally to blame or not is immaterial. They say that we are is going to be one of the major factors. There will be others. There'll be the intervention of the Pope and the Catholic Church and that white horse and false religion and all the rest of it. But this will also be a major one. And the aftermath will be a new economic system. Notice Revelation 13. Pretty drastic measures are going to be taken to put things back on a solid foundation and in their own perverted and way. The European economists are going to manage that. It's going to become very prosperous over there once again after it's sort of, been demolished now. They're going to have prosperity given back to them there. Chapter 13, verse 16 gives you part of the system that will be established, totally economic. Well, I mean, the whole system won't be, but one of the foundations will be. It'll be religious and political, too, and mainly that, ultimately. He caused all. That's the beast. I used to call him the beast of Belgium. I don't know where he'll live. I used to think he'd live in Belgium, but I'm not so sure anymore. Anyway, whatever beast he is, whoever he is and wherever he lives, he'll cause all, not some. Everybody's going to be named and numbered. small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand and in their foreheads. Whether that is literal or symbolic is hard to say. It could be a letter, a sign, a number stamped in with a laser to identify you when you go into a supermarket or a store or anything of the kind. It could be a symbolic mark, that is, a kind of a pledging of allegiance to that European power, involving allegiance to their days, to Sunday, and to their rules and laws and their religious beliefs. We're not sure if it's literal or symbolic, but there'll be a mark in the right hand and in the forehead. You think with the mind, and you work with the hand, so it could be symbolic. It may be both symbolic and literal. But notice, whatever it is, nobody will be exempt. But no man, any place, under that authority, can buy or sell, and that is, you see, an attempt. Because the regulation of buying and selling, of trade, of commerce, is going to be so radical and so total, it proves that if you have to have that kind of an antidote, solve a problem, the problem is very, very great, and it means that this will be predated by heavy economic problems. So no man can buy or sell a thing. It's going to have to be regulated totally. Say, he that has the mark, the name of the beast, the number of his name, and all the things that implies in the way of allegiance to that authority, to Europe, and coming under total subservience to that power. Now, I must underscore that this indicates, and in the first, total control, I mean dictatorial control, you see, of buying and selling, that is the basis of the economy. This is economic control. There will also come political control, and as you'll see here, the indication of total religious control. Anyway, that's going to be quite a crisis, and we'll live through it. We'll live through part of it. We will still be using pennies, though, God says, to buy bread while we're around. They won't be using pennies. Then they'll have this mark, and they'll be buying and selling, but the indication is that they won't have quite the same monetary system. Now, what was I going to say? The question we have to deal with is this. Knowing that there'll be some jobs available, obviously, because the nation will not collapse totally, but a lot of unemployment, knowing that the work of God must be done, and yet inflation could destroy us. It could cause, you know, a paper to go so high, it could cause the postal rates to go so high that we couldn't even do the work of God. Knowing all those things, we're going to have members working and have members receiving, in the context of that time, fairly decent salaries. How can we pay the rent, prosper, buy food, pay tithes, and be actively involved? I want to tell you four things that we're going to have to be doing and have to understand, and they all revolve around God and spiritual service to God. I will not recommend some sort of wild, crazy physical thing you can do, like, you know, moving to Alaska and building yourself a survival cabin. We have members who have done that, by the way. I like to write them all letters and say, come back to town, friend. This isn't what God wants you to do. And it isn't what God wants you to do. You know, you may have to get out of the smog and go live up in Mount Baldy, but I'd say come on down into the valley and work every day in this awful smog and go on back up there at night. But to hide out there is not what God wants. I'm not going to recommend you sell your house and buy gold with the equity. In fact, Scripture says, as I've already mentioned, someday they'll throw the gold in the street. And the time frame seems to be during the tribulation when this beast power regulates everything, and obviously he's not going to view gold as anything that's important. But, and I don't think it's wrong for a member of the Church of God to have a little gold if he thinks he would like, you know, he's got a few dollars and he wants to, you know, do a little bit of that. I don't think that is necessarily wrong, but there is a limit, and there's also a question of trust, and that is not the mainstay of our planning for the future. I know a member in the Church of God who did sell his house and who's basing his future on the fact that with $30,000-$40,000 in equity, he has bought gold about 3 years ago. It's tripled in value, and he is very proud of that. And he's got his gold scattered around in different banks and different safety deposit boxes because he feels someday the banks will all collapse. He's read Ruff and all the little books with the green covers, so he's following that right down to the letter. And he's got in different banks so that if this bank collapses, he can run to this bank and grab the gold there. And he mentioned to me that he even has gold in tin cans in his backyard buried, just in case the banks all collapse at the same time or the government calls in the safety deposit boxes and he loses that gold, but he'll still have the gold in the backyard in the tin can. And I think, oh boy, I really do. Again, I don't think that the Church of God would ever say a member who's maybe prosperous or has some equity shouldn't buy a little gold. And I don't know. I just would rather not even deal with that as far as giving recommendations. But I do know this as far as the end of the age is concerned. God says this, I give you power to get wealth. He doesn't say buy gold you know, and really work through the books on how to prosper in the, what is it, how to prosper in the coming disaster. And they had all these neat little methods, you see, all the stocks to buy, just these stocks. And, what you do in that area, I guess, is up to you. But that isn't going to get you through, I can promise you that. It's not a question of interesting little things you do, with your stockbroker or something of the kind. It really isn't. It's basically a spiritual thing. So I want to give you 4 points quickly in that area, revolving around God. Be ready. This is point one. Be ready and willing to make adjustments in your lifestyle. Please be ready and willing to do that. In the years ahead, now the adjustments will basically have to be minor, but there will be some. There'll be some cutting back. There'll have to be. I see no way out of that. God may not require anything major. On the other hand, maybe He will. Now, if the work of God were to cut our salaries by 10%, you know, would you be willing to cut back by 10%? But then, I mean, where do you stop? What if they cut our salaries by 20? Would you say, oh, at that point I've got to sell my house, I'm going to go get another job? Well, maybe some people should do that. I don't know. What about 30? Could you survive on half your present salary? I don't mean in the house you live in now or your apartment. You'd have to move. My answer is yes, you could. If you're making $1,000 a month, you could live on $500. If you're making $750, you could live on $325. If you're making $3,000 a month, you could live on $1,500. And I know you could, because I've seen people that do, and some of them live quite adequately, not fancily by any means. When I went to France in 67, the prices over there in 67 were almost the same as they were here when we left, so our budget really didn't vary hardly at all. It was amazing how the prices there were almost the same as prices here. What I found is that most of the members in France made about half of what people make here. Just cut right in half. They made about $250 a month, $300 a month. That was in 67 when members here were making maybe, you know, $500, $600, $700 a month. A lot of salaries have doubled since that time. They made about half, and they ate. Most of them had apartments, not houses. Very few of them had nice cars. They tended to have old cars, tin cans, you know, two horsepower, or whatever they, deux chevaux, yeah, two horsepower. And it wasn't very fancy. But, you know, just as many smiles there as here. Money doesn't make you happy, brethren. It doesn't. And when you get that through, you know, the thick skull, there is freedom. Money doesn't make you happy. It is not how many bedrooms you have, how many bathrooms you have, how much cash you have. It is whether or not you've got God's peace in your heart and God's spirit in your mind, and whether you're walking with Him and doing your part. Now, doesn't mean you have to change your lifestyle now. It just means you have to be willing for the future. And if you're greedy and house proud and you must have more affluence, more and more, and you've got to see your salary always going up, because it'll go up as the years go by, you see, but the prices will go up even higher. That's the difference. If you always have to have more and more and more, I think you're going to be very, very unhappy. If you learn to put the emphasis in the right place, you certainly will not be at all. Philippians chapter 4, verse 10. Time when Paul was cut back materially. Chapter 4, he was in jail. And the context talks about materialism and how the Apostle Paul felt about the Spartan fare, the poor meals, the food in jail, about the cold cell he was in, about the clothing that wasn't washed every day, and how he adapted to that. Philippians 4, verse 10. He said, I rejoice in the Lord greatly that now at the last your care of me has flourished again, wherein you were also careful, but you lacked opportunity. He said, you've begun to help, and they were sending money and things to him, parcels. Not that I speak in respect of want, for I have learned in whatever state I am therein to be content. He didn't say I'm fulfilled, and he did not say I'm thrilled. It is not fulfilling to go to jail. Now, some people say, yeah, but I'm not fulfilled. When I have a one-bedroom apartment and it's very constricted, I'm not fulfilled. Well, God isn't talking about being fulfilled. He's talking about being content. Paul was content in jail. He was not fulfilled in jail, and he wasn't thrilled to be in jail. See, life isn't always a question of being fulfilled or being thrilled. You understand what I'm saying? Sometimes you can be content in rather Spartan, limited circumstances. Paul said he was. Proof of his conversion. That was the peace of God flowing through him, changing his life. He said, I know how to be abased, I know how to abound. You have to be adaptable and ready to change your lifestyle, Paul said. Everywhere and in all things I'm instructed how to be full and how to be hungry, how to abound and how to suffer need. I can do all those things through Christ who strengthens me. Through the verse 7, the peace of God flowing through him. That was how it was done. And verse 19 says, now my God will supply all of your need. Not all of your wants, but all of your needs. According to his riches and glory by Jesus Christ. But you've got to decide, you've got to let God decide what those needs are, you see. And then sometimes he'll take some of them away, sometimes he'll add some, and you've got to be flexible in this age. And learn how to abound, how to be abased, learn how to adapt in your lifestyle and accept some of those cutbacks when the time comes that they must be made. I'm not saying they will be major, but they'll come. Probably basically minor. Some of them will be maybe a little bit more dramatic. Second point we have to remember is this. We must never forget that tithing and generous giving to God are the prerequisites of God's blessings, and all the more so in a time of economic chaos. You must not cut back now. Cut back in your lifestyle, but don't cut back on God. Some of you immediately cut back on offerings when you should cut back in your lifestyle when the pinch comes. Rather than give less, you've got to seek ways to give more, you see. And when it looks like your job is being phased out or you're not going to get a raise in cost of living or the salary may be cut, the way to reverse things is to somehow give to God a little more at that point in time so God can give you back more. And our immediate reaction is to cut back on God, you see, when it gets rough. Your immediate reaction should be to do quite the opposite. Malachi 3, we've read about tithing in Malachi 3 before, but I want to show you the context and then show you that it is a prophetical context. It isn't just a principle for God's people throughout the centuries. It's specifically a principle for us now. Applied to others only in type. But the truth on tithing and giving offerings is given to the people of God in the end of the age, in a time when the tribulation is very near. And God then says, do not cut back in tithes and offerings. Chapter 3, verse 1 talks about sending a messenger, preparing the way before the return of Christ. And the Lord whom you seek will come into his temple. This is the end of the age. Verse 3, he will sit as a refiner and a purifier of silver. That's the millennium. And he says in verse 5, I will come there to you to judgment. That's in the millennium. Verse 6, I am the Lord, I change not. That's now and then. From the days of your father you've gone astray. Verse 8, within that context, totally prophetical. And there's nothing in the context that is not prophetical. Will a man rob God? Yet you've robbed me in tithes and in offerings, and you're cursed with a curse. The whole country is cursed. And he says to bring the tithes into the storehouse. And he'll pour out a blessing. And that is a prophetical blessing. It is specifically a blessing for us now. I will rebuke, verse 11, the devourer for your sakes. That's the death angel. And he shall not destroy the fruits of your ground. And your vine will not cast your fruit before the time in the field. And you won't have to worry if you're a farmer about just horrendous crop losses like other people will. We've had that occur with crop losses all around, and our farmers have been protected. And all nations will call you blessed. And then he talks about how people criticize in verse 13. Criticize God. Verse 16, then they that feared God spoke one to another. Is this prophetical? Yes. God hearkened and heard it. The book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared the eternal and they that thought upon his name. And they, you see, the whole context describing a people who are obedient, who serve, who tithe, they shall be mine when? In that day when I make up my jewels. And I will spare them as a man spares his own son that serves him. That is place of safety, of course. That is prior to it, though, and after we arrive. That is a total promise of sparing. The whole context talks about obedience, talks about tithing. It talks about certain blessings that are brought down from God. I think it's pretty clear what God is saying. Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12. You've got to be generous to God. God is then generous to you. 12, verse 15. Do we cut back on giving to God now? Well, of all times, this is not the time to do that at all. Luke 12, verse 15, he said unto them, take heed and beware of covetousness, materialism, and the sort of hedonistic outlook we have about wanting more and more affluence. For a man's life doesn't consist in the abundance of the things that he possesses. It doesn't. If you think it does, you have a very great lesson to learn. You know, there are no more smiles per square inch in the USA than there are in some very, very poor countries. He spoke a parable and talked about a rich man. Verse 16, he had all kinds of riches. And he thought within himself and said, what will I do? I have no room left to bestow my fruits. And he said, I'll do this. I'll pull down my barns, build bigger ones, and there will I bestow all my fruits and all of my goods. So he had his plan, you see, for the future. I'm going to show this as a prophecy. He had his plan, you see, to live on through the economic chaos that lies ahead. He built himself a bigger barn and he began to hoard. But the Bible indicates that it's good to have a little financial cushion. It's good to maybe have a few months in the bank to pay the rent if you lose a job. It's good to have a little financial cushion. God says you should set aside for your old age and set aside for your children's children. And so it's good to have a little bit of an investment program sometimes. You know, as long as it is active and the money is being used. And God doesn't say it's wrong to invest if the money that you've invested is being used and you have a specific plan for your kids, for your grandkids, you know, something like that, and you feel there is time between now and that time to do that. But this is talking about hoarding. This is talking about the guy with all the gold sitting in his big safety deposit box, and that gold isn't helping anybody. Remember God said, I think it was in Matthew, he said, why didn't you put your money in the bank and gain interest? At least then the money is being used. But here was a fellow that, in a sense, wasn't using the money that God gave him as surplus to sort of prepare for the future, perhaps in a right balanced way. He was simply stacking it up in his own barn. So you see, the right type of investment is a totally different principle from hoarding. God condemns those who hoard. A little bit of preparation for the future, a little cushion for the future is one thing. And God said, look to the ant. He says, the ant in the summer prepares for the winter. Interesting, the winter lasts how many months in Palestine? About 3 or 4 months. He doesn't say the ant prepares for the winter, the spring, next summer, next fall, the following winter, the following spring, the following summer, the following fall, and then the summer and the spring and the fall, and then, you know, the ant doesn't do that, does it? Now, I had people say, oh, well, the ant. That's why I got all the gold in the trash can, buried in the backyard. The ant in the summer prepares for next winter, okay? Not for the next 35 years at the same time. There is a difference. So you see, preparation is one thing, but there are extremes. Hoarding is wrong. I'll say to my soul, verse 19, my soul, you've got all these goods laid up for many years. Now you can take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry because you've got the future all sewn up. And God says, ha! You have no idea what's happening in the future. You've got to have your life revolve around me. Some preparation is fine. Sure. We would not say that. But let's say putting your whole trust in that preparation and doing it in a way that involves hoarding is not God's way. God said unto him, you fool, this night your soul shall be required of you. Then whose shall these things be that you've provided? He that lays up treasure for himself alone and is not rich toward God is going to have his comeuppance someday. And then he said unto the disciples, and it was prophetical for now, therefore I say unto you, take no thought for your life, what you shall eat, or for the body what you shall put on. Now he means really in the years that lie ahead, because you'll see the prophecy here. Life is more than meat and the body than raiment. Consider the ravens. God feeds them in verse 24. Verse 27, consider the lilies. They don't toil, and yet God dresses them. Verse 28, and if God so clothes the grass that is today in the field and tomorrow is cast into the oven, how much more will he clothe you in the years to come, O you of little faith? Do not be, verse 29, of a doubtful mind. For these things, verse 30, are those things that the nations seek, and your Father knows what you'll need. And again, you'll see the prophecy in a minute, but rather seek you the kingdom of God. That means tithing. That means obedience. That means walking with God. Seek that kingdom. And sure, you may do a few things to sort of set some things aside for the coming financial crises and all that type of thing. I'm not going to tell you not to do some of those things. But I'll tell you what, most of us aren't doing a lot of that because God has given us a promise. And he says, seek the kingdom of God and all these things shall be added unto you. Don't fear. We should not fear little flocklet. Look like bags. It says a purse which will not wear out. As the years go by, a treasure in the heavens that doesn't fail. For where your treasure is, that's where your heart is. Verse 35, this prophecy for now, notice, going on. Let your loins be girded about and your lights burning. And you like unto men that wait for their Lord when he will return from the wedding. Blessed are those, verse 37, servants whom the Lord, when he comes, will find watching, but not only watching, praying, giving, being rich, being generous with God. And God will be with them. They'll be in the kingdom of God. And you can go on through the context and you see how literal and how prophetical it is. So as we come down to the end of the age, remember to increase giving to God. As some things are phased back in your life, do not phase back generous giving to God. Otherwise, God will not give generously back to you. That's awfully important. Third principle is this. We need to learn what the principle of equality is. God gives surpluses to some and cuts others back. And those who have a surplus need to realize that God ordained that surplus, you see. Purpose that surplus so that it could be shared in part with others. Now, a surplus, a blessing means some of it you spend on yourself, of course. Some of it you give to the work of God, of course. And some of it you share with others. So in Egypt, there was a surplus. That was because Jacob and his family had needs, and God created the surplus here so that those who lived in this other area could go over there, and the surplus, in a sense, was for them. In the land of Judah, when the early Jewish members went through a time of terrible famine, you know what God did? He created a surplus in Corinth. And the Corinthian and the Turkish members had a little bit more than he normally did, and that surplus, you see, was not for them. A little bit of it was spent by them, sure. It was basically to be used, and the Apostle Paul went around and took that little surplus and hauled it back to Judea and gave it to the Jewish members, and there was just enough for everybody. Now someday we're going to have to come to the point in the Church of God when we begin to move our surpluses around, and we will more and more as that time of need comes. It hasn't quite come to that point. Sometime, someday it will. You know, if 90% of us have jobs and 10% won't, those 10% are looking and are striving to find work, we'll simply move the surpluses around. The widows and the others who have fixed incomes will be blessed by God, perhaps not through money coming to them directly, but there'll be a surplus given to somebody else. And that'll be moved around to them. And it's a biblical principle. Years back, we used to wonder if, you know, someday some of the church members would not flee before others if, you know, in certain parts of the country because of persecution and things like that, if some of the brethren wouldn't have to pick up and leave months before the Church of God leaves for a place of safety. I think that's possible. But if that occurs and we've got to keep people over in our garages for 6 months and they don't have jobs, we're going to have to feed them, you know what will happen to you? You'll get a raise. God almost promises this, equivalent to the amount of money that is needed to support people that are living with you. That is within a time of crises. That's the principle of manna. That doesn't always work this way, but it did in Corinth. It did with the Jews. It does in any time of crisis work that way, and it's a miracle. So you have to learn to begin to share and view blessings in a certain light. 2 Corinthians 8. Notice what it says. The brethren in Judea were going through a terrible time. And you'll see that God blessed the Corinthians just enough. And he didn't give them the same incomes. I'm not talking about, when I say equality or equalization, meaning everybody has the same income. It means there's enough to cover all the different needs. And the brethren in Africa will always have lower incomes. Brethren here will always have higher ones. Brethren in Europe, someplace in the middle. But we'll be able to move around the surplus, and we'll cover the needs. Verse 12 of 2 Corinthians 8. If there be first a willing mind, I've already talked about that. If it's accepted according to what a man has and not according to what he doesn't have. For I mean, verse 13, not that other men be eased and you burdened, but by an equality. Notice that at this time, your abundance in Corinth may be a supply for their want in Israel. That their future abundance, when you're going through a rough time, may also be a supply for your want. God says, this time, you're helping out. You got a little extra, but he said, the next time around, they're going to be helping you. So God moves it around. It was a time, you can prove that. God talks about the crises in Corinth. The whole world was going through a lot of economic crises and famines. Sort of a type of our age. As it is written, verse 15, he that has gathered much had nothing left over, and he that had gathered little had no lack. Now, that was in the thing of when the manna fell in ancient Israel. They went out, and those who were strong and healthy gathered all they could gather. Those who were a little weaker and slower gathered all they could gather. And yet maybe the slower, weaker ones had more kids. So they didn't have quite enough. But God worked it out by miracles so that there was just enough, you see, for everybody. And those who had a surplus shared it with those who didn't have, who had a shortage. And it came out so everybody had exactly what they needed. And God says the principle works, and he will use it in time of economic strife, and always has, and will again. You've got to learn to share. Chapter 9, verse 8, God is able to make all grace abound towards you. Verse 9, however, you've got to be a sharing person, and you've got to view surpluses as that opportunity to share. As it is written, he that has dispersed abroad and has given to the poor, his righteousness remains forever. And he, that's God, that ministers seed to the sower, will minister bread for your food and multiply your seed sown and increase the fruits of your righteousness, and you will be enriched in all things to all bountifulness, which causes through us thanksgiving to God. And verse 15 says, thanks be to God for this unspeakable gift. That is this gift of what God calls the gift of equality. That is, he moves around the surpluses in times of crises so that everybody's needs are covered, as it was in the desert in Israel. That will be done to us in the place of safety and to some degree in the closing years now. And the last point I want to mention is this. And of course, the moral of what I've just said is that you ought to be learn to share and learn to share a lot. The fourth point is commit your job to God and you know, ask God to bless it and to use your job to make it an instrument. And he will. if you do it the right way. Now, if you're just putting in time on the job you have now, you don't like it, you hate it, you probably will lose it. You probably will lose it. Or if you view your job as a kind of a calling and as a gift and as a way of, you know, showing the world a silent witness of what a servant of God is like and does as a means of growing in character, and you have that sense that the job you've got, even if it isn't glamorous and glorious, is nonetheless a way, a tool that God is using in your life to help you and to build character and all of those things. God can bless that job and you can keep it through everything. 1 Corinthians 7, this will take a whole sermon. I'll give a whole sermon on it in a few weeks or months about jobs and what they mean to God and everything. This little principle, then we'll close. Verse 20 of 1 Corinthians 7, about jobs. Now remember in verse 26, he was talking about the present crisis. So there was a huge crisis in Corinth. Brethren were a little unstable, worried about their jobs and what would be done. And God said, okay, verse 20, principle is important. Let every man abide in the same calling wherein he was called. The calling here is talking about profession. And he gave an example. Are you called being a servant? Don't care for it. But if you may be made free, use it. What he's saying is this. He said if you were a slave or a servant then, and that was your job when you were called, he said, don't make a big deal out of it. He said, basically stay with it. But if you can get out of it and be, I can guide you into something better, he said, okay, go with it. What he's saying basically is be very slow to move out of a professional area that you were in when God calls you, because maybe there's a tie between that area, that labor, that job, and the kingdom of God and how God is going to work with you. And you can get yourself outside of his will. And that can be sort of dramatic. So he's not saying you must always have the same job. You must always stay in the same profession. He is saying be careful. And if God will lead you out and God takes you into a new area and you totally change lifestyles and job and employment, okay. He's just saying be careful. He's not saying don't change. He's saying be slow. Verse 21 is very clear on that. For he that is called in the Lord being a servant is the Lord's freeman. Likewise also he that is called being free is Christ's servant. You're bought with a price. You're bought with a price. Do not become the servants of men. Brethren, let every man wherein he is called. Again, this is a job, employment area. In general, therein abide with God. That changes everything. The inference is that it is important to God that you work and be employed in a certain area of life. And you can abide therein with God, and he can bless you in that area of life, and he can sanctify the job. We'll talk about that more. And again, it doesn't mean that if when God calls you, you're working in a gas station, that it's wrong to, you know, accept a job working as a manager in Woolworths or Wilco or something of the kind. It does mean be very slow, and God can bless you, and you can abide with God. Now, that was in a time of distress then because people were worried about jobs and professions and funds and that type of thing. And I'll talk more in a future sermon about what that means and how God works through jobs and how God can bless it. And you can keep a job through everything. Proverbs 28, and then we'll close on that. Ask God to sanctify your job and to work through it and to bless you in it and to bless the company. And to bless the bosses, and to bless the whole team that you're a part of. And of course, if God begins to move you out of it, then God says, be willing to move out of it, but don't be running madly from job to job and profession to profession, looking for the goose that lays the golden egg. Be very slow and careful in those areas, and try to rise and do a good job, and rise to the occasion, and be very much a part of the job. In a right way, not a workaholic, but respect it for what it is. Proverbs 28, verse 20, verse 18. Whoever walks uprightly shall be saved. He that is perverse in his ways shall fall at once. He that tills his land, that is really works at it, shall have plenty of bread. And yet God says, He's going to take away the staff of bread. And yet I'm not going to go to Kansas and tell all our wheat farmers in Kansas, sell your farms and move to town. You know why? Because some, there'll be blessings given in certain jobs. I would never do that. If they want to move to town, that's up to them. But God says, be very slow in doing that. He says, here you'll have plenty of bread. God will work this out somehow. He'll do it. If you do your part, he will do his. A faithful man, verse 20, the end of verse 19, that follows after a vain person shall have poverty enough. A faithful man shall abound with blessings. And some of you are faithful and some of you are not. Some of you have not been tithing. Some of you have been cutting back, and it's high time to resolve that problem, because you will not be blessed. And I'll tell you, you'll be a part of the 35% unemployed. If you begin to cut back on God, God will cut back on you. This is no time, you see, to be putting yourself in a position where you are vulnerable to all kinds of awful curses, economically speaking, because they're coming. A faithful man will abound with blessings. He that makes haste to be rich will not be innocent, you see. Don't make haste to be rich. Work through. Work up. You know, work in a valid area of the economy. And these get-rich schemes, when you fill your garage full of, you know, Ma and Jekyll's syrup, or you know, some other kind of crazy stuff. That's not what God is talking about. He that makes haste, verse 22, to be rich has an evil eye and considers not that poverty shall come upon him, and all the rest of it. He that, verse 25, is of a proud heart, stirs up strife. He that puts his trust in God shall be made fat, prosperous. He that trusts in his own heart is a fool. But if you walk wisely, you'll be delivered. If you give to the poor, if you serve, if you share, if you learn to share, you shall not lack. Nothing here about survival cabins, about, you know, 2 years of dried fruit in the garage. I know some of our members have 3 or 4 months worth of dried stuff in the garage. I don't. Maybe I should, and maybe someday I will. I'm not looking to that right now. That doesn't seem to be all that important right now. The Mormons have that. Every time you go into a Mormon house, be careful of the clothes cupboards and the closets, because all the dried fruit will fall out on you. Not when I was looking to buy a house, you know, all these houses, all these nice Mormon people selling their houses to move to the mountains to get away from the big earthquake, you see, some of them feel is coming, and the closets were always full of the dried food. Mine isn't. Maybe I'll put some in there for a few months someday, or in a couple of weeks. I don't know. But that is not of any great importance at all. If you give and you live in a way that is pleasing to God, you shall not lack. He that hides his eyes shall have many a curse. When the wicked rise, men hide themselves, but when they perish, the righteous increases, and so it goes. The main point is this: there is chaos ahead economically. But brethren, we have been told that we will live off the good of the land. That's a promise. It's a promise from God. He says, if you're ready and if you're willing, you'll live off the good of the land. That applies to those in fixed income. That applies to widows and the elderly and those who don't have a lot of expertise or background. God will somehow work these things out. He's promised to do it, and you can claim the promise. And when you do claim the promise, you'll see that fulfilling taking place.